Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post, Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
Oh, moderately crazed.
Wow. I'm happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, we're going to play a little game I like to call Choose Your Hot Take Adventure. This week's adventure is titled, Why Did Lightyear Bomb? Let us accept as given that the film's $51 million opening does in fact count as a bomb, given that projections were in the $70 to $75 million range, and appetite for family-friendly fare is largely unsated at the box office. I mean, this movie came in, I think, $25 million below Sonic 2. Not a great opening. And let us further accept as a given that quality, the how good a movie is, actually has very little to do with opening weekend gross, which we can see if we just look back to last weekend when Jurassic World Dominion opened $20 million higher than Top Gun Maverick, which that movie is 97% fresh and has an A-plus from CinemaScore audiences. Jurassic World Dominion is like 30% fresh and had an A-minus from CinemaScore audiences. So, you know, the quality doesn't matter that much for opening box office. So as I see it, there are four paths you can choose on this adventure. You crack open, you choose your adventure book. You're like, oh, this is very exciting. I'm a six-year-old and I'm trying to figure out box office results here. Let's do this choose your own adventure. Here's the first path. The failure of Lightyear is a natural result of Disney's focus on Disney Plus. And they're teaching audiences that movies will be available on streaming shortly after a theatrical run, if they even bother with a theatrical run in the first place. Given the fate of movies like Soul, Luca, and Turning Red, this is an entirely understandable commercial response. Here is the second path that you can choose on this choose your own adventure. Franchise fatigue has set in on the Toy Story series. Plus, there was a lot of confusion about what this movie actually was. And considering that Disney never did a very good job of explaining the concept of the film, which is actually very simple, it's just explained in two title cards right at the beginning of the movie. In 1995, Andy from Toy Story became obsessed with a movie about Buzz Lightyear, and this is that movie. This confusion and hesitance, understandable. I get it. And add in the fact that Chris Evans replaced Tim Allen as the voice for some reason, and folks had no idea what was going on. All right, those are the business paths you can choose, and I think they're pretty reasonable. We can discuss how much sense they make. But there are also culture war paths you can choose, and culture war paths, very unpredictable. Let's see how those go. Here's the third path. This is the conservative culture warrior's take. Lightyear is a failure, at least in part because of the backlash against Disney for forcing the homosexual agenda on the kids. There's the gay kiss, and executives are talking about how they want to insert gay moments into the movies to shape the culture, and the studio is pushing back against Florida's efforts to stop school teachers from teaching elementary school kids about sexuality and other gender-related stuff. You know, why would we, the conservative half of the country, want to go to something like this? Of course it's going to bomb. The fourth and final path is kind of the mirror image progressive take, right? Here it is. Lightyear's failure shows that the nation remains terribly homophobic, that right-wingers are pushing their don't gay say bills to gin up outrage. Meanwhile, social media is focused, on getting cartoon characters back into the closet. These reactionaries, they're dragging us backwards through time. So those are your four paths. You got a couple business paths. You got a couple culture war paths. Peter, which path are you taking on this choose your own adventure?
Well, I'll tell you the one I'm not taking. I'm not taking the culture war path because I actually think that has maybe not absolutely nothing, but very little to do with this movie's failure. And the reason I think that is because it doesn't seem like there's actually any concerted effort, any organized effort to boycott this movie. And even if there was one, just historically speaking, boycotts don't work very well. Also, because if you look at the geographic data for the box office here, this movie actually did quite well in the family-friendly market of Utah in the Salt Lake City area, which is not just family-friendly, but quite conservative. If this movie was going to fail because conservative religious families weren't turning out for this film, then I think you probably wouldn't have seen it do reasonably well in Utah. And so I just don't think that was a major factor. Again, I can't say that no family made a choice based on, you know, oh, there's a two women kissing each other on their 40th anniversary in one shot for 0.4 seconds. Man, we can't have kids seeing that. I'm not saying that no family made that choice. I'm saying I don't think that was the primary cause here. So I think there are two, there are a couple of issues. And one is this movie, if you look at, again, if you look at some of the appeal data, the demographic breakdowns, this movie didn't appeal to girls nearly as much. And it wasn't pitched as appealing to girls, even though there is, you know, a female lead here who sort of takes co-star along with Lightyear. It is much more of a kind of traditional, conventional sci-fi film, at least relative to the Toy Story movies, which really got the kind of four quadrant appeal just like maximized, right? Like that was a movie that moms and dads and sons and daughters, right? Like all types of, you know, the whole family really could enjoy, all four of them, I think, that's true. And you know, you mentioned reviews, and I think you're right that reviews don't exactly play a big part in making a movie like this underperform. But what does make a difference is word of mouth. And that's one of the reasons why Top Gun Maverick keeps overperforming in its second, third, and fourth weeks at the box office. It's because the word of mouth keeps being great. And this is a movie that people, they want to see it again, and they want to bring people who haven't seen it yet to go see this movie, to go see the movie at the theater. And so it's continuing to do really well. It's really hard to imagine that Lightyear has great word of mouth, because it's just not the kind of movie that's built to inspire anyone to be really excited about it or to tell other people, oh, you've got to see this movie. Instead, it's the kind of movie that people sort of dutifully show up to see because they like the franchise, because it seems fine, because it's got the Pixar stamp of quality on it. And it's a fine enough movie, but I think it doesn't deliver the sort of film that anyone is going to be passionate about, which is really strange given that the whole concept is that it's Andy from Toy Story's favorite movie. And we can get into that,
we'll talk about that
later, but it's actually a sort of a failure of marketing and concept there, which is that this is supposed to be someone's favorite movie, but instead they've made a movie that is just a sort of tolerable, like, box checker in the Pixar mold. And that's a movie that in this environment has much less of a chance of doing well.
I want to push back a little bit on the word of mouth stuff, because I mean, occasionally you do see a movie pick up huge word of mouth over the course of the first weekend, and like the numbers keep getting higher and higher and higher. You saw a little bit of that with Top Gun Maverick, though, where you're seeing most of it is in second, third, fourth weekends. And you saw it with Jurassic World, the original Jurassic World, which, you know, projections were like 120 or 130 million or something like that. And it ended up grossing $200 million opening weekend because people were like, oh my God, this movie's so much fun, you got to go see it. This movie, I don't think, you know, after the Thursday, Friday grosses, it stayed about where it was going to be. I mean, there was not a huge drop off, but there wasn't a huge pickup either.
But that goes to the sort of concept in marketing. And I just think this movie was marketed weird. And the fact that they couldn't explain the concept, right? Like movies that have word of mouth and that draw people in, movies that you like that over deliver on their premise. And people didn't even know exactly what the premise it was here.
Yeah. Which is weird because it's actually a pretty simple premise. Again, we'll get into that more later. Alyssa, which adventure are you choosing here? Which path are you going to walk down?
I am not going to walk down the culture war path, but I do think that there is something interesting that is happening here. And I want to talk about the lesbian relationship in this movie for a second, because it's a weird thing. This is a movie that ostensibly came out in 1995, which is, you know, 2 years before Ellen says, yep, I'm gay, on the cover of Time magazine. It is, I think, 6 years before Evan Wolfson founds Freedom to Marry. 9 years before John Rausch publishes his sort of manifesto on gay marriage, making a sort of like almost conservative civilizing argument for it. And so, you know, this is a movie that has like the politics of like 2008 with regard to its inclusion of a like totally domestic square lesbian couple whose relationship is depicted in like
2012 or 2016 even. I mean, by 2008, even Obama was still opposed to gay marriage.
Sure. I mean, I just mean that, like, you know, California had that, like, brief spate of marriage legalization then. I mean, I'm trying to be, you know, generous here.
Okay. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it's much later than that, because even it wasn't just that Obama was opposed to it. The idea that a committed
that a Hollywood movie
gay relationship that is would be okay in a kid's movie is something that is really quite new in popular consciousness. Again, not something I'm personally opposed to, but like it's that's new in popular consciousness. And I have a hard time imagining that this movie could have come out in this form even 10 years ago.
Exactly. And so, but what's interesting about it is that I think there has been a consensus sense among folks on the left and in Hollywood who did an enormous amount to, you know, to advance gay rights in the first place, that this, that, you know, square lesbian couples with kids are sort of a settled fact in the American landscape. They're no longer controversial. And the fact that this has, you know, become yet another point in conservatives, you know, war on Disney, in the pushback on, you know, gender-affirming care for trans kids, suggests that even the most conservative version of gay rights is not actually as sort of well enshrined in American culture and sensibility as I think people, including me, might have thought a year ago. And so, you know, to a certain extent, do I think, you know, Ben Shapiro is actually incensed about Lightyear or is like tweeting about Lightyear for, you know, for the clout and for, you know, the ongoing culture war? Like, yeah, absolutely. But if, you know, that 0.4 seconds of a completely chaste kiss between a couple with a kid on their 40th wedding anniversary can still be a culture war issue, then I think the acceptance of, you know, married bourgeois, extremely domesticated gay couples is perhaps more surface than I think a lot of folks had assumed over the last 5 or 6 years. And that's an interesting thing. I mean, it raised, you know, I think a lot of developments in general have raised questions about the left's decision to rely on the courts for, you know, advances in social equality. Certainly we're seeing that with Roe v. Wade right now. But if people can still get mad about something this anodyne, I think that is kind of sobering, even if the controversy is a little bit manufactured. And so I find it interesting. I think that Lightyear probably isn't doing huge business for a combination of the business stories that Sunny has outlined. But even though the movie isn't very good, and I think the box office for it is certainly not very good compared to what expectations might have been, there is, you know, something kind of interesting nudging around the edges here that I think is worth paying attention to and not just dismissing.
I wonder how much of a controversy this would have been if this movie had come out a year ago or 18 months ago, essentially before the big fight between conservatives and Disney over the Florida law and the leaked videos of the executive who's like, of course we're trying to influence the culture with our movies. I mean, like,
yeah, I mean, this is the gay agenda from 2004, right? Like, you know, right. And to the extent that Disney is pushing a gay agenda with this movie, like, yeah, this is exactly what, you know, Evan Wolfson, who founded Freedom to Marry, was doing, you know, when I interned for him in college, like, doing the, like, gay people, we want to be exactly as bourgeois and normie as you, right? And that's, I mean, that's what the movie says, essentially. But that sentiment itself, I think, has gotten somewhat caught up in the culture wars in a way that should be a little unnerving for LGBT activists.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. I mean, I am very dismissive of online outrage just in general. I think it is almost always overstated by people who are perpetually online, which includes 99% of journalists. You know, we are on Twitter all the time, so we see all of these things happen in real time, more or less. And you know, most people aren't. Almost nobody is on Twitter, and almost nobody who is on Twitter uses Twitter to the extent that people like me and Peter, and to a lesser extent now because she's smart, Alyssa, use Twitter. I mean, it's a weird distorting thing. But I don't think you can entirely dismiss it, Alyssa, for the reasons that you suggest. I mean, it's an interesting thing to have happen. And again, I think it's mostly just a confluence of all this stuff happening at the same time.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that, again, if this had been sort of disconnected from the conservative spat with Disney, like, this is all Chris Rufo's fault, right? I think we can all agree on that.
Yes, I would say he is the inciting incident here.
Well, so let me, I'm not a Chris Rufo fan. That's an understatement. But Sonny has argued on this podcast that it is bad business for corporations like Disney to weigh in on some of these, you know, on some of these laws and sort of make social justice through the state law, like, cause for the corporation. And I do wonder, like, Sonny, to your point, you argued that maybe this would be different if this movie had come out a year or two ago before the Disney versus DeSantis fight. But what if this movie had come out and there had been no Disney-DeSantis fight? If it had come out right now, do we think that that might have changed anything? And do we think that there are executives at Disney who are thinking, not only did we cause, you know, sort of these legal headaches with DeSantis in terms of our tax status. And again, this is not to justify what DeSantis did. Recent magazines published a bunch of arguments against all of this, et cetera, et cetera. But do you think that Disney is looking at this and wondering, maybe next time we'll put the thing in the story, but we will not make any extracurricular comments, especially about, you know, sort of hot button laws that are in play or, you know, about to be passed in California, in Florida, in Texas, at the national level under the next Republican president, presuming there is one, right? Like, do you think that the Disney executives will look at this and think, maybe we should have pulled back on the, again, not the actual film itself, but the extracurricular messaging?
I mean, I think they probably think that already anyway, like before this film. I think looking at everything that has happened in Disney and surrounding that before this has been just disastrous on a PR front for Disney. Like, nothing good has come of any of this. Now, we can argue that I don't think it's nearly as bad financially as some folks do, but I really don't think that the box office here has that much to do with, you know, conservative online Facebook and Twitter outrage about Lightyear and the gay kiss. I just think that the only reason that it is like now a focus of everybody's conversation is because it is happening in concert with everything else. I mean, I just think that, like, it is basically undeniable to say that this is a bigger deal now than it would have been 2 years ago before all this stuff. You would have absolutely had, like, conservatives complaining about a lesbian kiss in a Disney movie, but it would have been a, like, more marginal thing. And now it is, like, the thing that so many conservatives are focused on. This is just another plank of that.
Yeah, and I think Disney is going to continue to be caught between its employees and some of its customers. And I don't envy them the task of finding a way through that.
I don't really have a way to end the segment, so I'm just going to go to the next part here, the ad for the bonus episode. Okay,
good prep, Sonny.
Well, no, I mean, I just don't. We chose our paths, right? We've all chosen. We're all basically on the business path. We're all going to page 14, and now
we've chosen our own adventure.
The CFO is like, "All right, so how are we going to avoid this in the future?" And we're like, "No more straight to Disney Plus. Everything in theaters, or everything in Disney Plus. No more theaters." That's the next branch, but that's a segment for another time. So, yeah, make sure you tune in for the bonus episode this week at atma.tothebulwark.com, where we are going to be talking about the actual movies of 1995, not the fake movies like Lightyear, but the actual movies that came out in 1995. Which of these films that came out in 1995 would have inspired us to pick up an action figure at Al's Toy Barn? And now on to the main event. So Lightyear, it's a joint Disney-Pixar production that dares ask the question, why was that little kid from Toy Story obsessed with a movie that sucks as badly as this movie sucks? As I said previously, this is the movie that Andy saw before getting a Buzz Lightyear toy for his birthday. Pretty simple. It stars Chris Evans as the titular Space Ranger. He's replaced Tim Allen for some reason. He gets a colony ship stranded on a strange planet after diverting it from its mission to explore an uncharted world. Maybe there's some new life. Who knows? In an effort to right this wrong, he tests out new light speed crystals. Unfortunately, each of these near light speed tests costs him about 4 years, right? So he's basically jumping every 4 years to every day that he's gone. That's how relativity works, folks. Weirdly, nobody in this movie knew what relativity was before they started doing the test. He comes back, he's like, oh my God, 4 years. Wait, I thought you already did the light travel thing all the time.
That's because he's happening? A toy.
Every time he leaves, he comes back and the colony has grown a little bit larger in the 4 previous years. His fellow Space Ranger, Alicia Hawthorne, who's voiced by Uzo Aduba, raises a family. She grows old. She dies. She leaves her granddaughter to carry on the family legacy of Space Rangering. It is worth focusing on this sequence in particular for a moment, I think, because it's the sort of thing that Pixar used to do and used to do insanely well. The obvious parallel here is the aging prologue in Up, right? Which is a series of shots that show a life lived in full with all the joy and sorrow that brings. And I feel comfortable saying this. It's a sequence that usually reduces everybody to tears in the audience, just Niagara Falls, Frankie Angel, every time. This sequence does not have that impact at all. It just doesn't. And I don't know exactly why. It's hard to pinpoint the reason. Maybe it's just because Buzz and Alicia are colleagues rather than lovers. I don't know. Maybe it's because they were not really given much reason to care about them before that whole sequence starts. I don't know. It just doesn't land.
Can I note one thing about this that I found really hilarious? So
yes.
Alicia's wife, Kiko, has no lines. Like, she doesn't have, as far as I can tell, there's not like a voice credit for her. But also, we see the entire course of the relationship as Buzz watches them through the door of their apartment, which gives the impression that the entire relationship between these two women is happening in, ta-da, you guessed it, a closet.
I didn't think about it that way, but yeah, I can see that. All right. But anyway, but like this is so, how so much of the movie feels. It feels just kind of perfunctory, right? Buzz returns to the planet after a successful test of the light speed crystals, and he comes back, and it's 60 years later, and there's an alien invasion going on, and he has to team up with a ragtag group of misfits to save the day. But like, that group's ticks are so rote and so obvious and like really kind of inane that you can pinpoint exactly how everything with them is going to play out, right down to which character repeating itself is going to show up as a post-credits tag as part of a he's still going joke, which character's tool on his, you know, little jetpack vest is going to come in handy at some point during the climax. Like, everything about it is so telegraphed and set up and obvious that it's like kind of frustrating, actually. It's frustrating to see all this happen. And this movie continues the weird trend in Disney and Pixar movies of trying to get away from like conflict between people to making all conflict internal or trauma-based. From like Moana to Frozen 2 to Ralph Breaks the Internet to Encanto to Turning Red, it's just been one movie after another about the evils of failing to accept oneself and the failing to accept others, a theme that is actually literalized here. And we'll talk about that in a minute when we get to spoilers. And yes, look, I understand that internal character growth is important, but that doesn't mean that we can't have like a Jafar or a Scar or an Ursula or a Hades or a Sid from the original Toy Story, right? Now, does it? Maybe it does. I don't know. Most of all, though, this movie's just kind of bereft of joy. It's not fun. Not a fun movie. And if the kids in my screening were any indication, it's incredibly boring, too. They were just literally... I mentioned this in my review, but there was a kid who literally he came to the screening wearing a Buzz Lightyear costume. He had the whole costume. He was there. He's excited. And within 15 minutes, he was just doing wind sprints up and down the aisles. So I don't know. Kids didn't seem to be that into it.
Alyssa, maybe he was training. Races.
Alyssa, if this was one of the first movies you were allowed to watch during your emergence into the pop cultural scene, would you have just given up on movies and TV for good?
Quite possibly. I mean, like, why bother with this when you can go read Little Women? I mean, I'm sorry. It's...
Nerd.
yeah, shocking. I'm a nerd who likes classics of, you know, girl literature.
Lit.
No, I mean, I think it just... There's no character in this who is intriguing or feels much like a person in any way, right? I mean, like, the Buzz Lightyear we see here is not that much more animated or deep than the Buzz toy. You know, Alicia Hawthorne is like, I mean, I'm sort of interested in what she's doing, like building a colony on a foreign planet for, you know, 60 years, but I'm also the kind of dork who just like desperately wants a huge, you know, gazillion-dollar HBO adaptation of Kim Stanley Robinson's Mars trilogy so we can, like, get to the debates about terraforming. But would this have appealed to me when I was, like, 8 years old? Absolutely not. I mean, in a weird way, it reminds me of, like, it's as if Pixar had taken a wrong turn into some of the DreamWorks stuff where it's like, you know, oh, we're going to have a character who's, like, ostensibly a sort of edgy criminal. It's like let's have collections of character tics instead of actual personalities at work here. Like, everyone has one characteristic, right? Like, Buzz is macho. Alicia is, like, pragmatic. Izzy is afraid of space.
Afraid of space.
The character voiced by Taika Waititi, who, like, honestly, I'm sort of sick of in voice roles at this point, has no confidence. And then the criminal is a criminal. And also there's a robot cat.
Robot cat.
I like the robot cat.
Also, I like that the robot cat is clearly a nod to Bill Clinton's, like, first cat socks. That's, like, the only 1995 thing about the entire movie.
Wait, how?
the cat in the movie's name is Socks.
Oh, is it? Is that?
Yeah.
Is that,
okay. But S-O-X.
Yes.
I mean, I guess.
But it's literally the only thing that feels authentically 1995 about the movie.
It's funny, you mentioned DreamWorks, and like, if this had been a DreamWorks movie, it would have been better, because at least it would have been manic and goofy.
Yeah.
As opposed to like kind of ponderous and dull, which is how I felt watching this. I don't know. Peter, what did you make of Lightyear?
It's more manic than a lot of Pixar films. And that was something that sort of irked me. You made this comment about Turning Red, Sonny, was that you thought it felt a little more DreamWorks-y, a little less calm than a typical a Pixar movie. And I defended it in the case of Turning Red just because I thought of the subject matter and sort of the fact that it was about a 13-year-old girl that the movie starts by acknowledging is in some sense an annoying 13-year-old girl.
Yeah, it's like it's a very specific, like, manic 13-year-old energy, yeah. Whereas this has a more generic, like, traits!
Yes.
We have traits energy.
And this movie has a bunch of sort of frenetic bits. It has all of this sort of quippy humor that is more DreamWorks-y. And so, you know, you said you would prefer this if it felt more like a DreamWorks film. This, to me, felt more DreamWorks-y than a typical Pixar movie, and not in a good way. It did, of course, have all of those sort of like, oh, here's the slow bit where it's a little bit sad and you find yourself and you're sort of worried, right? Like, they had the end of second act, like, you know, come to, like, find yourself, be sad, it's dark moments. But it's not a movie that feels like it ever slows down. And the action scenes are actually sort of subpar by Pixar standards. So this is something that I've always liked about Pixar movies, is that even going back to the original Toy Story, even in children's films that are not, you know, hyper-violent or anything like that, the action scenes are directed exceptionally well. They're just really exciting sort of there's a lot of, like, the motion is extremely clear and well and sort of and packaged well and well telegraphed, right? So a good action scene controls the possibility space so that you're always about a half step behind what's going on screen. But when something happens, it doesn't feel out of the blue. And Pixar does this better than basically any other sort of filmmaker of the last 40 years, except maybe Steven Spielberg and the Wachowskis at their best. And this movie has one pretty good action scene, and that's the chase across that sort of moon-like surface, I don't know, about two-thirds of the way through the movie, where the robots are chasing the hover thing, and they're sort of throwing stuff at the robots behind them. And it's pretty good, but it's not great. And I actually thought that the sequence where Buzz, you know, doesn't age while everyone else ages is pretty good. It's better than you would see in a lot of children's movies. I mean, we're not going to go watch like Minions 12 or whatever it is that's coming out here. But if you guys have seen a Minions movie, there are some like, okay, I guess that's kind of funny in a kid's gag kind of way bits. But there's nothing at that level of like thoughtfulness in terms of script development, in terms of storytelling. The Minions films, which do huge, huge business, don't even bother to give us perfunctory or pro forma versions of those scenes. And so that's why I think this is a fine movie. This isn't a bad movie. It's one that never goes off the rails, that never feels like, oh man, this is just dumb. This is a disaster. This isn't working. But what it is, it's like someone who didn't work at Pixar did a script analysis of all of Pixar's movies. And then was like, how can we make an hour and 45 minute sci-fi movie based on that? But also like account for the fact that DreamWorks is selling a lot of tickets these days. And it just feels like box checking at every moment rather than like there's any sort of authentic character drive or story that they needed to tell here. In some ways, because that's what it is. This is a spin-off film that needed to check a bunch of boxes and was, to some extent, I think, afraid to take this to the types of places that the best Pixar movies go, because what Pixar does at its best is take kid concepts, like kid-friendly concepts, execute them in a way that's not too violent or too emotionally abrasive, but also takes those ideas and pushes them into storytelling and character territory that is actually like emotionally resonant and like that sort of that can get to you. And sometimes it's a little bit manipulative, maybe even very manipulative, but it's quite effective. And there's a sort of there's a, bravery isn't the right word, but there's a willingness to go places that even a lot of adult, nominally adult films won't go in these Pixar films. And Lightyear has none of that. Just none of that at all. It doesn't take you anywhere that isn't, I mean, you said it was very obvious, Sonny, but I would say that even more than like the sort of script setups being obvious, this, the emotional arc here is almost irrelevant, right? Like I didn't care about it at all.
I didn't care about it at all either. It's just frustrating. It's so frustrating. Literal. It's all right. I want to talk about the big third act reveal, which is that Emperor Zurg is not like an evil robot from another dimension. It's actually just Buzz Lightyear, who has gotten older and he's come back in time somehow with magic, more or less, and is trying to reset the past. So it is a literalization of this idea that your biggest enemy is yourself and your regrets and your traumas, to the extent that he's literally, young Buzz Lightyear is literally fighting old Buzz Lightyear. And I was like, all right, can we stop with this now? Is this trend done? Can we have like actual villains again, please? Just give me a bad guy who is a bad guy. That's all I want.
Well, and the thing that I found interesting about that reveal is that this movie is sort of supposed to be like Andy's Star Wars, right? You know, and yet it has almost no adventure whatsoever, right? Like it's his Buzz spends most of the movie literally flying in a loop, right? Like he slingshots around the sun and comes back through these hoops. He's like returning over and over again to the same apartment. And the end result of the movie is not that he figures out a way to leave the planet, but that he decides to stay. And Star Wars, you know, if we think back to Empire Strikes Back, there is that moment when, you know, Luke's in training with Yoda and has this vision where he like splits open Darth Vader's helmet and sees himself, right? And so even the Star Wars movies have this moment that and have this through line about, you know, the possibility that yourself can be your own worst enemy. But in Star Wars, that's like, it's a striking image. It's something that George Lucas like trusted the audience to sort of remember as a through line and a concern. And then the movie just like moves and is propulsive and has adventures and multiple sets and places you explore and capers you have. And the movie is not weighed down by its psychologizing. I mean, it's given some heft by it, but it's not, you know, in order to like not become Darth Vader and figure out who he is, you know, Luke has to, there are things he has to do, right? Like he has to do training stuff and go, you know, like rescue people and fight people and figure things out about the world.
He has to learn to become an adult. And to and to be able to deal with adult conflicts and challenges, which are genuinely difficult in the way that like children have not yet experienced and have been protected from. And that's part of what makes that movie, what makes the original Star Wars trilogy and the first film in particular, such a favorite for sort of people who, for kids who are growing up. And is that it is a movie that is in many ways child-friendly and targeted at kids. But especially once you get to the second film, it is also a movie that delves into adulthood and the sort of and the coming of adulthood.
Yeah.
And that just sort of to me like goes back to the core problem with this movie's weird concept of being Andy's favorite movie, is that I have a very distinct memory of being in elementary school. This was when I was probably in fifth grade, and we went around the class. I don't remember whether it was a formal exercise or not, but like talked about our favorite movies. And among the favorite movies of like 10-year-olds that were listed were like Aliens and Terminator 2. Empire Strikes Back was listed. I think some of the kids, you know, listed things like The Wizard of Oz, which is its own, you know, sort of growing up, quite like weirdly dark story. But so many of the movies were, in some sense, adult films, even if they were kind of teenager action movies, right? Actually aimed at adolescents, despite being rated R. And maybe the kids had not actually seen rated R movies and were lying about it. Distinct possibility. I don't know. You know, I was young.
Kids
right?
are liars.
But they all wanted to be seen as liking something more mature, something that was in some way sophisticated. And this is not at all a sophisticated or adult-seeming movie. And Andy, a sensitive, smart kid who has had hard times, he's like lives with a single mother and has a weird, you know, sort of terror bully living next door, That kid would have wanted to project an image of his favorite movie being right, like, to other people. He would have wanted to at least for other people to see him as someone who was more adult and capable of grappling with something more than what Lightyear gives us. And so just the movie undermines itself with its concept. I think if you had actually, if you just said, this is a Buzz Lightyear adventure in space and not bothered to explain it at all, not tagged it to 1995 and not said it's Andy's favorite film, it would have played, it still would have been a kind of mediocre film in certain ways, but its fineness would have been more tolerable because this movie just sets itself up for failure with its very weird concept that it doesn't at all actually execute.
A friend on Twitter suggested that it would be very funny if Lightyear was actually an enormous bomb in 1995 and Andy was like the only person who loved it. That would be clever.
But I think in a weird way, the sort of emotional failures of Lightyear writ broadly and its sort of interesting timidity about, you know, the gay relationship that has been kind of its part of its marketing as like inclusive and a first are related, because there is a version of this movie where Buzz kind of sees life passing him by. And that is made, you know, not just in that like Alicia is getting older, but that their experiences are diverging, right? That like he, you know, he feels this obligation to keep continuing on the mission, even as his regrets about not getting married, have a family of his own, grow sharper. And then the final adventure is not a chance for him to confront himself, but a chance to actually do what he regretted not doing by parenting Izzy, Alicia's granddaughter. You know, I mean, that would have been the more interesting kind of inversion to do. But it would have required, you know, treating Alicia's relationship with a little bit more seriousness, having Buzz, you know, like, be sort of a third wheel, you know, sort of observe it in more finely and in more detail, which would have required depicting it in more detail and more nuance. And then getting rid of some of the sort of antic quality, like you literally could have done the entire sort of second and third acts of the movie without either of the two sidekicks, right? Like it could have been Buzz and Alicia, and it could have been about, you know, that could have been a parental relationship as opposed to another sort of sexless comradely one. And that, I think, actually would have given the movie some heft, you know, in a way that would have
still wouldn't have appealed to an 8-year-old boy in 1995, though.
I mean, if they had cooler adventures, right? Like, you know, that could be a part. Like, it's not like, it's not like action dads weren't cool in the 90s, right? Like, that was like Harrison Ford's like whole act, like, you know, Air Force One, all that stuff.
Right, but he's not a dad. I mean, that's your point. Like, he doesn't, like, he has no life experience.
Right, but what, like, the movie could have been him getting life experience to, like taking his coolness and toughness and, you know, lending some emotional heft to it in the process of doing stuff that's actually awesome instead of just, like, robot nonsense. I have a strong prejudice against just, like, mindless robots as villains. I find them incredibly boring. But that's a side note.
All right, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Lightyear? Peter?
The most tentative possible thumbs up.
Alyssa?
Thumbs down.
Thumbs down. I like, Peter, your squishy thumbs up is a mark against your character. You should throw that thumbs down.
I think
down
it's at least a little bit influenced.
It's fine. You can't, it's fine.
Yeah, well, fine is a tentative thumbs up, and it's fine's, a little bit influenced by the fact that we saw yet another 90s throwback film last week with Jurassic World Dominion, and that movie was so bad in every single way. And this movie is not great. It's definitely not a great movie, but it is pretty competent, and I didn't hate any bit of it. I just wished for more at every single step.
Competent fineness. All right, that is it for this week's show. If you loved it, make sure to check out our members-only bonus episode coming Friday to atma.thebulwark.com on the movies of 1995. Make sure to tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.